Recall first what we said about the maturing of the mind. Nature matures the body and hands over to us individually the task of bringing the mind to maturity. And this maturing of the body is linked up with all that concerns what are commonly called the three lower chakras, the Mooladhara, Swadhisthana and Manipura, which deal with food, preservation of the individual body, with sex, the perpetuation of the species, and with the commerce of everyday life. And not merely the external commerce of things, but also the digestion of our experience, our thoughts, our ideas, and so forth. All that is associated with Manipura. In the process of self-preservation, we are not and cannot be entirely concerned with the self. Because self-preservation in the world as it is and as we are constituted and live today involves interaction with all others around us and in fact with the total environment. In this process of interaction with others, we grow to a sense of society. We grow to a sense of relationship with other people around us. Now, this sense of relationship, this social sense as we call it, is at its lowest grade. And by that I mean particularly that our social sense is not devoid of selfness. It is self-oriented. It is a projection of oneself into other selves, those whom we love, as we say, particularly our family or friends or whoever it may be. It is self-oriented, a projection of oneself into others, and therefore always maintaining the dominance of self-interest in relationship to others. We'll consider others up to a point, but only up to a certain point. And then, if the circumstance compels us to go beyond that point, it's ourselves that we will serve and not the other. Nevertheless, the first stirrings of the sense of mankind as a whole, of which I am part and parcel, first grows and stimulates the heart center, as we call it, anahata, here, which in Kabbalistic terms is Tifereth. Tifereth has many wonderful significances. It is associated with Enoch, the great patriarch, Enoch of the Bible, and the name Enoch means teacher, tuition, teaching. It means intuition to start with and insight in its perfection. It is associated with Hermes and it is associated with the sign Libra, the balance, equilibrium, poise, and so on. So now, the first stirrings of a sense of brotherhood, a sense of the universality of the unity of the universe grows in us here. When this sense comes to full fruition through the living of the religious life in its fullness, in its perfection, then one has traversed the path, including that extraordinary aspect of it, the crossing of the abyss, until finally there is complete communion with transcendence itself, which remains permanent. And this implies the perfect maturing of the mind. And in the state of the perfectly matured mind, we have the perfect mindfulness constantly functioning. And it is this aspect, mindfulness, which is the ground aspect of meditation or contemplative prayer or whatever you like to call it, which is the specific expression of it in certain very favorable circumstances. But mindfulness can remain constant throughout the day, which means that if the mindfulness is of this order, and it is the mindfulness of the mind that has come to full maturity, then it is the state of complete communion with all the senses and our discursive thought process as the cords of communion. Because then, in all our sense functioning, and in our thinking and feeling and so forth and acting in the world, we are always unself-centered. Now, so these four higher centers, as they are called, Anahata, Vishuddhi, the throat center, which we saw yesterday, deals with prophetic speech, not just the chatter of the world, but prophetic speech, with Ajna, where the command of the teacher, of the master, is heard, and Sahasrara, the thousand-petaled lotus, which comes to full activity in supreme communion, in samadhi. These four centers come into complete activity. You will remember I spoke about the union of energy, shakti, which resides, which is associated with the center at the base of the spine. And this shakti is always presented as a coiled up serpent. It's very interesting, this coiling up idea. Those of you who have gone into modern physics, that part of physics which concerns the structure of the atom and the play of energy and so forth, we'll see all sorts of remarkable correspondences there with this old symbolism of the serpent. Now the serpent as such, ahi is the Sanskrit term, ahi, the serpent, is the life force. It's the life energy. What we talk of in religious terms as life force or life energy has as its most concrete expression all that science has investigated regarding the forms of energy, electricity, magnetism, light, chemical energy, mechanical energy, and so forth. That is part of the serpent. That is only the most concrete manifestation of prana energy as a whole, life energy as a whole. The subtlest expression, of course, is in terms of what has been called pure mind, or creative energy, this thing which I have sometimes spoken of as action in eternity of the fundamental creative energy of the universe. And that is associated with the brain. Transcendence literally resides in the brain. And as I've repeated several times during this week, transcendence, which is omnipotent, is non-compulsive. Being centered in eternity, time has no meaning for transcendence. By virtue of mere presence, omnipresence, this omnipotent power of transcendence stimulates all that is concerned with manifestation, with emergence, with development, with fruition, and the whole activity goes on. So now, in fulfillment, life energy, prana, ahi, the serpent, functions completely in all his aspects. Now the serpent, the word serpent is a word which has no relationship with a snake as we know it. It is a symbolic term for the one made wise. It is a symbolic term for energy in action. This is the meaning of the serpent. And this life energy, in religious terms, is at its highest level, its deepest nature, the cosmic fire, what is termed the cosmic fire, which stimulates everything to come to its transcendent fulfillment. So the serpent deals with that. And you will notice that the serpent in the Garden of Eden story addresses the woman, not Eve, Esha, before she is called Eva, Eve. You see, addresses the woman, this feminine principle, the divine female, and that conversation takes place. Now this serpent is presented in the Rig Veda in two aspects. One is Ahi Budhniya. Budhniya, the dragon of the deep, the serpent of the divine wisdom, the power of the divine wisdom, Ahi Budhniya. And the other is Ahi Vritra. Vritra is regarded as the demon who withholds the waters and causes drought. Of course, ordinary scholarship, falling into the trap of nature symbolism, has said, oh, the old Rig Vedic Indians were talking of the droughts which overcame them when the rains failed and all that sort of thing. It has nothing to do with physical droughts or rains or monsoons or anything. The waters referred to are the waters of life. And there are the two aspects of the waters of life. What we call the waters of eternal life and the waters of our life in its ordinary biological sense. In its ordinary biological sense, it refers to that which is mortal. Water is the fertilizing power, the fertilizing agent. See? And the waters of eternal life is that aspect of primordial energy which sustains our awareness in terms of total and constant communion. Now come back to these two higher the highest centers, as we call them, the center between the eyebrows and the thousand-petaled lotus, Ajna and Sahasrara. And you remember I said the other day that this is the region which in the Rig Veda is described as heaven, Vyoman, heaven, not Dyaus. Dyaus, the heaven, is more related to the sky we see, that sort of idea. But Vyoman, this is heaven here, right within us, in which transcendence itself resides. When transcendence resides before I have come to realization, it is something which is unknown to me. It is there everlastingly waiting, patient. When I awake and come to realization and realize this, these two chakras as the supreme within and controlling the total organism and the total life of the psychophysical organism, this is represented by the god Indra. The term Indra also means the kindler, he who lights up, sets you on fire. The fire of the spirit, which is not a destroying light, destroying fire. It is a smokeless fire. It is pure light. And it is the life giver and the controller without compulsion. As and when you come to spiritual fulfillment, all imposition of self-will upon the universe and upon your own self disappears. That is the state of complete and utter harmlessness. Pure love, transcendent love, has its full meaning only then. Now this is Indra, the Lord of Heaven, as he is called. And Indra, as is said in the hymns in the Rig Veda, and out of the 1,028 hymns, at least 250 are hymns to Indra. Indra is said constantly to drink great draughts of Soma, again personified as the god Soma. Soma is the god of inspiration. That is what Soma is essentially. He is also the god of healing. There is a marvelous hymn to Soma in the Atharva Veda, in which you get the lines, and remember the Atharva Veda is, if anything, a little bit older than 1000 BC. It says that the blind sees, the cripple walks, and so on. Now the god Soma is the god of inspiration and healing. And Indra constantly quaffs these draughts of Soma, this tremendous power of inspiration. Now, use your imagination carefully. Here is the spine, from the brain right down to the base of the spine. Here are the centers, Muladhara, the coiled up energy, the primordial energy which is life in all its manifestations, in all its aspects. But as far as the body is concerned, obviously in those aspects which science would talk of as chemical, electrical, and so forth. Then there's Svadhisthana at the genitals, this energy functioning in terms of the perpetuation of the species, Manipura, in terms of the commerce of everyday life and affairs, and Anahata, where the first first entry into a true social sense, into a true sense of the brotherhood of man, etc., begins to grow. This is the fourth one. So there are three below. And of course, with the development from the fourth one up to the top, you get the complete maturation of the mind, the complete freedom ultimately from all selfness and self-orientedness, and the spiritual fulfillment of each individual being as such. Use this anahata as the base now, not muladhara, not the first center. Use this as the base and turn up the spine to face the upper part of the spine. So that number one will face number seven. Muladhara, the primordial energy, will face transcendence itself. Svadhisthana, at the genitals, and you remember we saw that this is the supreme expression of separate egoistic selfhood, because the sexual function is the supreme self-expression as a separate self in our lives. That faces ajna, where the command of the master is heard. And remember, Indra is lord of ajna plus sahasrara. And Manipura, which deals with all the process of interaction, interplay, commerce, digestion both in physical terms of food and in psychological terms of thoughts, ideas, learning, knowledge and all the rest of it, will face Vishuddhi, prophetic speech. Now you are beginning to get a glimpse of it, I think. Now see what happens. Indra, the lord of heaven, in the Rig Vedic hymns, is said to have attained his lordship of heaven by slaying the demon Vritra, the serpent, the life force, in his aspect as demon. Now, the serpent acts in terms of biological creation at Svadhisthana, the center at the genitals. The serpent, in his aspect as the great wisdom giver, the supreme wisdom giver, and penetrator into ultimate reality which transcends all thought and all speech, at ajna. Now you see at once what is the meaning of ahi budhnya and ahi vritra. Now, every act which asserts the separate self causes a spiritual drought. Isn't that so? Because in terms of the spiritual, in terms of the ultimate reality, there is only a unity of the entire universe. But here is the separation and the most forceful, the most tremendous expression of that separateness. Now if you work this out for yourselves, you will see the profound significance involved in that aspect of religious discipline which comes under celibacy. Now the great mistake made by people who want to lead the religious life is that they blindly, unknowingly, they don't know all this at all, they impose upon themselves total forcible abstinence from sex. This is hopelessly wrong. They get nowhere by that. You see? Until the vision dawns and one really sees for oneself. You have heard me say these things in words. Don't, for goodness sake, take them on trust from me and say, oh, Feroz said so, therefore I shall do so and so. Don't do it. The doing must be the natural consequence of your inward vision. If your inward vision and your mindfulness is utterly perfect, this aspect of the expression of your total life energy will naturally give place to the other expression, the transcendent expression. Then you are the real celibate. Not till then. Otherwise, you are merely forcing yourself to do something in order, selfishly, to fulfill your ambition to become a great saint or some such stuff. That is all. Have no illusions about these things. Remember also what I said yesterday, that the united Shiva Shakti, coming downwards, right back to Mooladhara, the root center, transcendentalizes all the worldly functions. Sex itself gets transcendentalized. You have read, those of you who have been, are interested in all these matters and the customs and the procedures of the past, you have read all kinds of things of the deliberate begetting of children. Not in the ordinary way of a man and a woman marrying and begetting children, but a deliberate, chosen begetting of children. And usually it's put in the form that the high priest, the hierophant himself, begets a child upon the high priestess or the oracle or whoever it may be. It's put in all these forms. But here is, as far as I can make it clear and open, in clear terms, just precisely what happens to you psycho-spiritually, relating it to what happens to us in the ordinary way psycho-physically. So now you see the meaning of Indra strikes with his thunderbolt. The magnificent sort of picture, you know, you can get. The Lord of Heaven hurling his thunderbolt. This is what Zeus does too. This is what all the lords of heaven do. They wield a thunderbolt. You see? Hurls his thunderbolt at this demon Vritra, and lo and behold, the desert blooms. The waters of life are let loose and the desert blooms. And this desert which blooms is first in spiritual terms. And after the desert in spiritual terms has bloomed, then the effects begin to seep down into the world of affairs, our everyday life in this world, which is a veil of tears really, as far as man's activities anyway are concerned. It does that afterwards, and now you'll see why I have always said, although the books don't say it, as far as I know, that the combined Shiva Shakti comes down and doesn't stay there, the link between the transcendent, the timeless, the infinite, and that which belongs to mortality and time and ambivalence, duality, sorrow, conflict, suffering and all the rest of it. It does not just stay there, but it goes right down and transcendentalizes your entire life. And if you read the lives of the holy ones, you will find in a peculiar way how this is borne out. They have no problems of livelihood. Their livelihood is always there, rightly obtained. Nothing goes wrong. Pain, pleasure come, yes, but they just take it in their stride. As I said yesterday afternoon, you remember, for our meditation meeting, you are standing, you're sitting on the river bank, watching the river flow past, without attachment, without aversion, with complete understanding, completely in communion with everything that there is. Whether we call it good, evil, horrible, wonderful, makes no difference. But you are in relationship to it. And in that relationship, you are a blessing to it. And this is what the Lord of heaven does when he strikes his thunderbolt at Vritra, the demon who withholds the waters of life. And Vritra, of course, is the demon who is connected with the second chakra, the Swadhisthana, which asserts self. The sexual expression is just the supreme expression. But in all our activities in life, we are constantly asserting ourselves. If it is only in terms of planning out things and going contrary to what somebody else plans, and then there is a little bit of ruction and a rumpus and difficulty and all the rest of it. These are all self-assertions. Be very, very careful. Now you will if you understand this, you will understand why the holy ones never interfere. And people get very upset. They say, good gracious, if you see a child walking into the middle of the street, are you going to let it get run over? What do you think the Holy One will do? Of course he'll grab the little scallywag and drag him back to the pavement. But how will he do it as contrasted with me, the ordinary mortal, doing it? I, the ordinary mortal doing it, will be conscious in terms of that particular fellow and me saving his life. No. Here was a situation fraught with suffering. This is the whole situation, the situation of suffering, of tragedy. And the action which was performed is the action which transformed the whole situation of suffering into one of harmony. There is no I, there is no child. You see, the spirit, the consciousness in which these things are done makes all the difference between an ordinary human action with all human frailty and difficulties present and a divine action. That is all. It's as simple as that. And of course, also as difficult as that. So these things have to be borne in mind. Now you see, the relationship between all the teachings regarding religious discipline, one's development, one's fulfillment and fruition, and as presented in the Veda and in India generally, the Far East will say, and as presented through the Kabbalah and the great religions of Western Asia, especially Judaism and Christianity, you'll see the relationship between the two. Zarathustrianism, which lies in the middle, Iran, where it sprang up. On this side is India with all her religions. On that side come Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. See? Iran is a remarkable link because the Zarathustrian teachings present the transcendent side with the emphasis upon physical action all the time. It must be put into practice physically. And the Zarathustrian has been regarded as the champion of God. Now, of course, we think of the word champion in terms of shining armor and flashing swords and all the rest of it. But here, the shining armor is your purified life. There is no protection greater than that. And your sword is your awakened intelligence, which sees straight away into the truth of the thing at once. This is the sword. You all know how in the different myths of the world they have presented the conferring of invulnerability upon the great hero. And the hero, in most cases, is not born of a human man and woman, but is born of a god and a human woman. You have the classic instance of Heracles. You have the example of Achilles. In Zarathustrian teaching, you have the case of Prince Asfandiar, who was the son of King Gustaspa, at whose court first Zarathustra was heard and supported powerfully. And he conferred this boon upon King Gustaspa, who asked for 4 boons, and this was one of them. And he conferred invulnerability upon the prince. Just as Thetis, the mother of Achilles, dipped him in the waters of the river, and excepting for his heel, which left him mortal in terms of the manifested body, conferred invulnerability upon him. And so too with Heracles. But finally, that poisoned shirt which he wears burns up the body. That is just one loophole. You find it in the story of Siegfried in the Ring of the Nibelungen story. Siegfried is invulnerable, etc., except that one spot between the shoulders in his back. And remember, the shoulders, one shoulder is associated in the Kabbalistic teaching with the mercy of God, Hesed, the other shoulder with stern judgment and punishment, Geburah. Now, if each functioned absolutely at its own level, you couldn't maintain a manifested universe. These two are mediated by Tifereth, which stands for compassion. Beauty, justice, harmony, the Son of God resides here as the Father God is there. But more particularly associated with the right eye, with wisdom. Abba, the Father, the term that Jesus always uses. Some scholars say the word Abba means out of the unknown origin. It is the unknown origin, Abba. That's the thing that is called the Father in heaven. Of course, you can't possibly have in the New Testament wisdom or unknown origin, forgive them, they know not what they do. The whole thing becomes meaningless. You have got to put it in personalistic terms, but you've got to understand it in the right way. That's by the way. Now, what is this invulnerability that is conferred? When Indra is truly Lord of Heaven, when you have really seen for yourself what the truth is, there is an inward power which makes the psyche unkillable. You can be hurt. But this hurt is no longer a personal hurt. I get hurt, I get upset, I get offended. It is the hurt which you invariably feel and continuously through your life feel because the springs of compassion are everlastingly flowing and the eye of wisdom is never closed. So you see the suffering of the whole becoming process, of the entire world, of all mankind, and seeing it, you suffer with it. You bear the cross of matter, manifestation, upon your shoulders. This is the meaning of the cross and the bearing of the cross. You see? But you are now safe, as we say. Although the psyche is intensely more sensitive than in the ordinary state, this psyche has become invulnerable. This is the conferring of invulnerability by the transcendent one, the gods. Ones, the gods. Obviously, you can't make any physical body invulnerable. It's quite impossible, that's all. This is invulnerability. And this invulnerability is something which grows out of vulnerability. If you will lay yourself open, completely sensitively to anything and everything that comes and everything that is, without turning away from it, because you have seen, because you have understood, and because the well of compassion is filled to the brim and it overflows from you, then you will find that with that vulnerability, that openness, the psyche is in fact invulnerable. Your psyche absorbs everything that comes, absorbs it all, and instead of letting that which is absorbed remain at the plane of the three lower centers, it is taken up from here, the plane of mankind as a whole, right up to transcendence itself, and undergoes its transmutation. What that transmutation means, I can't talk about in words. But it is an energy. I can only use rather vague and poor language of this sort. It is an energy which is a benediction, not only to mankind, but to all life. And when I say all life, I don't differentiate between what we call matter and say that it is dead, and that which is not matter, which is organic, is alive. What we call matter is very much alive. Whatsoever is alive in terms of the manifested universe moves, it vibrates. And every single atom, every single congeries of energies vibrates all the time. It is a vibration. It is not a thing. It is not a particle. It is not particular. It is not limited. And nevertheless, it manifests particularity and limitation, although it is transcendence itself embodied. We don't know what it is, and yet we know it in these wonderful forms that we see around us, as well as the horrible forms of life. So accept it all. Understand it all. Take it all in. And you will know the true meaning of salvation. The very rose of your salvation under the skies is within you all the time.